have. And so much of what we can do as government is listen to people who already are experts on their own neighborhoods and admit when we don't know everything there is to know. I don't know everything there is to know about your neighborhood. Whoever you are listening to this, you know where a crosswalk needs to be on your block better than I do. And when we go out and say we need to paint a crosswalk, we should listen to the people who live there and say, here's where the safety hazard is.
How would you be working with somebody who, for instance, had opposed the ballot, the charter change, and has this, you know, and also might want to undermine some of the initiatives that have been passed in recent years by the voters?
Yeah, so first, I would say that maybe 20% of the city is a registered Republican. They deserve to be represented on their city council, and they haven't been. There are people who are much further to the left than people that have been elected, and people whose views don't fit neatly into a box, and everybody deserves to be represented, and I think the new form of government will do that. It breeds a more honest politics. I lived in Seattle for college. I left, I came back, and in between they changed their form of government, not quite as much or in the same way as we did, but it did yield a more diverse council ideologically. And as someone who's worked on advisory groups where we're trying to make sure that they're representative of the city, including ideological diversity, I think that's really valuable. I think, again, the way I would work with people who are supportive of a different vision of the charter is to say, you know, let us try this first. Let's do it in a way that addresses whatever the fear is. If it's a preference issue, I think we have to, you know, go back to what the voters voted for. And that's not, you know, I think we could all say, if I was writing this from scratch, would I write it exactly the same on any of these ballot measures? And the answer is probably no. And that's actually one of the challenges with ballot measures in the first place. I talk about building a city that listens, because a city that listens is safer and more prosperous for everyone. And the issue with ballot measures, we govern a lot through ballot measures in Portland, is that they are themselves a reflection of people feeling that they weren't listened to by their elected leaders in the first place. And sometimes that yields something where you have to vote yes or no on the whole thing. But that's what happened. And if people voted for it, we should implement it, wait a few years, and then talk about it.
How would you have the city address the issue of the climate crisis?
Yeah, so these aren't new issues, and it's nice that people are increasingly aware of them. I wish that it didn't take things like the hurricanes and so many other crises to get everyone to care, but I think at this point, at least in Portland, everybody is aware that's an issue. There are very particular levers that the new city council will have when we get there in January. There's the air quality permitting process for Zenith, and that affects its land use compatibility and its authorization. So I think that's where we focus for that particular.
Let's go like, a little bit more into the nuts and bolts of that. I mean, right now, the clean air permit is it's in DEQ's court right now. And DEQ keeps pushing the line down of when there's going to be hearings and there's going to be an actual process of public input. So what can the city be doing? And what would you do if on city council, particularly if DEQ doesn't make this decision before the end of the year?
I'm anticipating that they will not make the decision before the end of the year. And as a result, it will be in the hands of the new city council, which I think is a good thing. In many elections, you have members of a city council who are, you know, lame ducked for a couple months. In our case, the entire system is lame ducked, and we should be looking to our current leaders to create space for the new leadership of the city by not making binding decisions for the future, including things that will affect our well-being. Part of the reason you know that I'll care about this, I mentioned I have asthma. I'm also, if the big blue bomb goes off, which is that large blue tank that you see on the south side of the St. John's Bridge, my personal home is gone. The hope is that as we bring attention to it, get people out on the river so they can understand what we've lost by giving all of the riverfront to the industrial sector. And as we talk about the risks in very specific terms, that will help. The other thing is not taking backroom meetings without having folks who are, you know, you'll never see a one-on-one meeting with Zenith from someone who's truly committed to addressing climate change. And it's important that we have representation from people like Tank the Tanks in the room at all times, but also doing things in public to the degree possible. Portlanders generally will do the right thing on climate if government makes it easier to do that. And that applies to whether we're talking about the CEI hub, that applies whether we're talking about our modes of transportation, you know, ensuring that people are taking light rail. They'll do it if we have the light rail where they live and it's fast and frequent and eventually fareless. We need to do those things. That there is a pattern where the folks who are least likely to be represented, folks who understand that in government, is going to be really important to ensuring that we're not only doing things that help everyone generally, but we're also targeting some specific aid. And on that subject, I forgot to mention earlier, we have to protect PSEF. We absolutely have to protect PSEF.
Okay, let's talk more about that. A couple of the candidates from District 4 on the last forum that I hosted with that, one candidate said just what you just said about PSEF, which is the Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Yes.
Two candidates were talking about how it's brought in so much more money than they expected, and therefore the excess money, or in one case, one person said, the interest should be used, in her words, we should be flexible about it. And her idea of flexibility was that we should use it for filling potholes. So I just wanted to get your response to that.
Yeah, it's also been discussed to use it for funding Portland Street Response. On my website, I say I am a sworn enemy of potholes. I am also the only candidate who's worked for policy development of Portland Street Response. I support both those programs, and we can fund them elsewhere. PSEF needs to be used as the voters intended. And until and unless someone can say, you know, climate change is solved, it's over now, what are we talking about? I don't understand why anyone could possibly say it brought in more than we need. PSEF has, there's always another program that could either be scaled up that's already in existence, or one that we just didn't fund before. And you can watch the committee and their discussions. They have great ideas that they just haven't been able to do yet for whatever reason. Some of it is you need time to develop them. I'm not putting any blame on them at all. But I am saying I would prefer strongly that the money remain in that space. And then that's what is authorized by the voters.
I mean, for some reason, and I'm not sure I understand why, Portland Department of Bureau of Transportation has been underfunded. So that's where the potholes come up. And this one candidate was giving a rather strange explanation of how filling potholes was actually a climate issue. Because cars slowed down. I don't know what it was about. But to me, it gives me a sense of really watching what's behind some of the people who are running, who were opposed to the charter change in the beginning. And so there's, I guess, a sense that you're, what you're describing, Samir, about respecting the will of the voters.
Yeah, I think people are sick and tired of voting for things and then watching their elected leaders undermine them.
The city, I mean, climate activists have been arguing for several years that the city can rescind the Lux that Dan Ryan and company got agreed upon. Samir, how would you go about doing this?
Yeah, as I said before, I think the particular lever that's going to be the most relevant is the air quality assessment and all of that process, which from what I've been told, and I think I want to both respect and jump on what Sam was saying, this is not the thing that I am the greatest expert on either. What I will say is that that is likely to come in January or February from what I've been reading and hearing. And so that is the opportunity that is most relevant. That, and then also showing that Zenith has not made it cannot hit that 5-year timeline with all the information that we have about its operations around the country.
We have a couple other issues that come up. We've had a couple listener questions. One of them is, what do you think the city should do about slow police response times? And this listener has found that he's not been getting police response sometimes at all when he calls. And this guy actually thinks that the police are on strike.
There's several factors that go into this. One of them is we have slow response times at 911 before the dispatch to police ever happens. And that is partially solvable through some technical fixes that are pretty boring in terms of how the calls are triaged, and partially we just need to hire more dispatchers. It does take time to train a dispatcher, so there'll be a little bit of a delay there, but in 2025 we can start to make really, I think, make a lot of progress towards getting to the national standard, which is 90% of calls being answered within 10 seconds. That's the first thing. The second thing is adjusting how we're deploying what responder is being deployed to each call. I'm a very big supporter of Portland Street Response. I want it to be 24/7. That's why I've been endorsed by every endorsement you can have related to PSR, and I've also worked on policy there. If we are taking the types of calls, unwanted person, suspicious person, you know, those sorts of public disturbance calls that PSR is better at handling, and we're making sure that they are the responder of choice and not police, that frees up patrol resources to go there. I also support the continuation of that staffing study, which at the Community Safety Division where I worked, we started in 2022. It got put on a long-term hiatus. I think we need to bring it back and understand how we're deploying the resources we've got in terms of specific responders and ensure that they're able to respond to multiple things at once. But I think the biggest thing is making sure that we're moving the work to the correct responder. And as we scale up what Portland Street Response responds to, we'll see faster police response times in the areas of the city, including North Portland, where we see a lot of delay. You know, with an all-new city council, we need people who understand how the city works but aren't creatures of its broken culture. Building a city that listens means having people who will change their viewpoints on how to achieve something without changing their values if they hear from people that this is not the way to go forward. I think you deserve a government that listens to you. You're entitled to have a government that reflects your priorities and values. You have a right to be heard. And as someone who studied human rights and worked in that field for a while, I'm committed to making that happen.
You are listening to This is KBOO Community Radio. I'm Althea Billings, news director at this lovely establishment. In this episode, we are revisiting Running on Air, our Portland candidate roundtable series from earlier this year. We're hearing from the winners of District 2 covering North and Northeast Portland. That includes Ilana Pertle-Guinea, Samir Kanal, and Dan Ryan. Consider supporting the important work we do here at KBOO with a donation during our Catalog of Connections drive. We're aiming to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. Think you can help us out? Donate online at kboo.fm/give or text the word KBOO to 44321 to show your support for grassroots community radio like this. Let's get back to the show. My first question, why did you decide to run for city council? Commissioner Ryan.
It was back in 2020 mm-hmm. when I thought our city was in a pretty messy place, starting around 2015, 2016. And I thought we weren't addressing some of the basic services. And I started hearing from more and more Portlanders that they just were like ready to bail, like people that were like multi-generational families and such. And so when my friend, Commissioner Nick Fish, passed, I kind of got recruited by friends. And next thing I know, I decided to dive into a political race. And then and I won. So I've had the task of serving during Portland's most difficult time. And I think that I've done my best, of course. And I think we've actually, especially the last 2 years, taken a ship that was kind of rudderless. But it feels good to start to have a little bit of momentum. So when three of my colleagues jumped in the mayor's race, I wasn't really ready to make a decision, but I thought, oh, it's time.
Yeah.
So I looked and no one was running for, you know, council with any experience about how hard it's been to get us, I think, into some sort of momentum. Like summer 2024 was, I think most people would say, was better than summer 2023 and definitely better than 22, 21 in terms of activation and joy on the streets and people starting to like enjoy living in Portland again, if you will. And so I just thought I want to be a part of building something new. I'm also like to build things and I like, I like challenges and changes, and I also like mentoring. So I thought, I'm just going to go for it and hopefully be somebody that can really add a lot of positivity to this great experiment that I really think is going to work if we are just mindful about it.
I want to talk a little bit about the new system of government for a second. What do you see as some of the opportunities and challenges of this new system? How do you feel about this pivot in responsibilities with the new council compared to what your work as a city commissioner has looked like over the past four years?
I'm glad I've always tested high on like flexibility and adaptability because this is really different than the previous. I've run, I think, more than anyone in a short period of time. So this is like my third race in four years. And it's really different. And what I like about it is that it roots you in the district that you're running in. And it's also going from a form of government where you had executive responsibility and legislative responsibility and constituent responsibility citywide, which was a capacity issue for a long time, which is why I've always been in favor of some model like this. And now, as someone that's lived in District 2 42 in my 62 years of life, it allows me to really be in the neighborhoods again that I grew up in, that I have some deep roots in. And I'm already enjoying that. I'm enjoying like the more opportunity to have conversations with Main Street business owners, more opportunity to be out with the neighborhood associations and just neighbors in general. You know, I ran in 2020. No one could go door knocking because they didn't want you to come to their door because it was COVID. And so, and then with citywide, it was really hard to do that. And so it's just been really entertaining in a way to just go up to people's door. I'm really bad at it though, because I, my campaign, I like people, I always have. And so I just am so taken with the dialogue. Mm-hmm. So I spend, like, political consultant would just tell me I'm a failure because I spend way too much time at each doorstep when they actually want to talk. But it's so rich. Like, I'm hearing, what I'm hearing actually is a lot of similarity in thought. So they just want services to work. So it sounds really boring, but one of the main motivations for me to run was that I'm so concerned with some of the population loss we're having. I'm concerned with how many people from, again, every, from the far left to the far right, complaining that they're paying too much to live here and their services are going down.
Yeah.
So we really need that city manager to come in and be a badass and really get our culture to a better place so that our public servants are seen and appreciated. And then they get some fire in their belly to really improve. And I'm a continuous improvement nerd, and I really hope to have a more focus on what success looks like in each bureau, in each customer service area, and to be excited about measuring what goals they'll come up with the community. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, checking the ego at the door and being humble and just continuing to learn. Because clearly, we're not doing a good job of delivering services all across the board. Our partnerships with some of our nonprofits need to improve. And so I think I'm just really comfortable. I've been calling that out and to help with that process. And as a legislator, I'll have more freedom because when you're overseeing a bureau, you have to want them to come to the meeting next week. And so I tend to be very focused on results, and sometimes that scares people in the bureaus. And so I've had a little bit of a challenge sometimes with that tenderness, if you will, and people and their feelings. I'm like, guys, it's just a job. Like, take it seriously, but don't take yourself so seriously. Mm-hmm. It's about improving the way we're implementing, and I'm with you. But I always saw my job as a commissioner, as the chair of the board. The board is everyone who lives in Portland, and I represented that. And then I was a liaison between that and the bureau. Unfortunately, I think over the years, too many commissioners felt like they were part of the bureau, and they would become too much of that mindset. And so I'm already kind of there as a legislator. And so I look forward to having even more comfortable stance with that, with being more independent as a legislator.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask if you're going to miss it, but it sounds like, you know, I mean, that's part of the motivation for it all, is to stop having you pulled in all of those different directions. And let's get into a new system where you can be pulled in different directions.
We've become too, not just siloed, I think we've become too protected. And and I'll just say COVID really escalated that. There was more opportunity to, you know, you're home in your pajamas on a camera that's off. There's just less accountability with that. And so that's one reason I was really big about, you know, being back in the office. It helps when you're with one another and you're rehearsing, if you will, together, and then you perform better.
Yeah.
So I'm also hoping to see more of that enthusiasm.
What do you see as some of the most pressing issues for your district?
I think we've been in denial about how severe our poisonous drug crisis is. There's been drug epidemics throughout my life. I lived in Harlem as a poor actor in 86 through 90. And the crack epidemic was very, very in your face. Like every day I would step on a vial, they were called, and a glass vial. Now it kind of went from needles to foil. So you have like these indicators on the sidewalk of what's going on. But the amount of open air drug use, and then how scientists and behavioral health specialists are just baffled by how poisonous and extreme the new meth and fentanyl is, and how it quickly does damage to the brain. So I think we've been in denial about that. And it's been frustrating for me as someone in recovery with a family history of this. And I think I've been pretty well known as taking on former Chair Kefauri and others in the homeless world to say, I know not everyone who's homeless is on drugs, but it's a much higher percentage than you're saying. Mm-hmm. And how do I know that? I know that from just losing my brother on the streets in 2014. That's when I started to first see the denial. But I also saw it when I was a commissioner and had a dotted line to the county and I'd go to meetings. But I was overwhelmed and shocked at how they weren't talking about this in 2021, 22. And so I started to feel like a broken record. Thank goodness Commissioner Myron and others were saying the same thing, so I didn't feel totally alone. But I do believe that if we don't get a handle on this, it's going to continue, just like addictions take out families. It's going to take out our city if we're not more honest about how challenging this is. So that's the big picture issue that I want to always lift when I'm in a dialogue like this. Locally in District 2, especially when you get out to the north part of the district, there's always been a geographic challenge, period. I went to Roosevelt High School in the 70s. We always felt like we were not seen. But there's also a geographic thing with the cut, the railroad cut and the river. Like if there's a big one, the fact is we could be isolated out in that part of town after a big one. And so we have to look at what's the emergency response to that. And I don't think we don't have a good enough plan right now, if there is one. No one showed me it. And so I think when you're a district of three people representing North and Northeast, we can have more influence on that conversation.
There was one thing that you said, Commissioner Ryan, that I wanted to just ask a little bit about. Particularly, it made me think about how often addiction is treated as a moral crisis and that drives a lot of the rhetoric. And so is that a helpful frame to bring into the conversation, or is it one that you know, legislators maybe need to avoid?
It's morally appropriate and responsible to not be in denial about how big the problem is. Mm-hmm. It's our job as leaders to call that out. When you're in the 12-step recovery, your first step is to admit you're powerless and to surrender. As elected leaders, I think that's where we should be at, because what I'm seeing is that we're in denial still, and we're not just admitting we have a problem, and we should surrender that we think what we're doing currently is working, because look around, it's not. So how can we be bold and try, do something and test it, measure it, see if it's getting any better results? When I pushed for the Safe Rest Villages, it was my frustration because in the 2020, for example, we voted to shelter more people with services. And then I get to the meetings and it's all about housing first. And I'm like, did we just manipulate the voters? Because I'm now in this meeting and I'm the only one asking about shelters and services. Everyone else is talking about housing. Of course we need housing, but the voters voted for this. And so I had to wait for ARPA money to come down from on high to do the bold initiative, to get it through City Council 5-0, to get just enough support from the county elected leaders so they would, you know, play. But boy, the headwinds at the county when we were trying to build this were actually more severe than the headwinds that were obvious on the local news from the neighbors. You expect neighborhoods to not want something new and different that seems like it could be unsafe for their kids to come in their neighborhoods. So those were brutal meetings. We're talking like 500 to 400 people on Zoom calls saying really colorful things about me in chats. And so I have a few bruises and they've all healed. And that's one reason I'm running, because I know how tough you have to be and you have to keep getting up if you're going to do something that matters. And you have to have enough love for your city to do things that are hard and not worry about being liked by every special interest group while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is such an important conversation that doesn't usually get enough airtime. But, you know, what I learned in my recovery and with everyone in my family that's in recovery, the five of us that are alive of the eight children are all in it, is you go from isolation to connection. And most of the people you see strung out on the streets, they're isolated. They're not having a good life. It's not compassionate to just allow them to continue to live in that existence without any inspiring support to help them get to the next place. But as Will said, when you're just going for your next hit all the time, it's really difficult. Like the only time my brother was open to recovery was actually when he would do something bad and get thrown in jail. So after he would withdraw in jail, which was excruciating, and I don't think there was enough medical support in the jail for that, and that's what we need is withdrawal centers with medical support. Then at that moment where you get through a little bit of that excruciating, painful process, your head and your heart are connecting just enough where you're going to say, yeah, you know, my life isn't going very well at all. In fact, it's miserable. You know, when my brother went from being married with two kids and a decent job within 10 years being on the streets and not knowing who he was, basically, that's not the life that they want to live. And so we have to just encourage recovery. So when we had places like Bybee Lakes come onto the market, and to see the county reject them just because they weren't a part of their preferred provider network, it was like an insurance company, like, no, this new outfit doesn't do the right care. Actually, they're doing great care for people that are willing to want to make steps. And so I hope that the county continues to loosen up and accept vendors and providers, better word, that are enthusiastic about having the audacity to really try something different. Because our current provider network, the status quo, is so housing first, housing only. And I think they're not equipped to know how to deal with much of the crises that we're dealing with on the ground, which is maybe why they just want to talk about more housing.
Thinking about Portland's approach to the climate crisis going forward, is this a priority that you share? Is that something, what are you thinking about that kind of thing?
I think it, first of all, it starts at home. You know, when you get up there, you start to notice how your practices have changed over the years. I was lucky that my dad did organic farming before it was popular and I was a little 4-H kid. So that was already in my DNA, if you will. But this summer I grew more food. We grew more food in our backyard than we ever had before. We have more tomatoes. We have a salsa garden. We have a smoothie garden. So we spent a lot less money on berries because, you know, we're the berry state, especially on the west side of the Cascade. PSF gives us this golden opportunity because unlike any other city, we have this revenue stream. And what are we going to do with it? And I think like a lot of our ballot measures we passed, they're pretty broad. Like people vote on them like clean air, yes, PSF. But they don't know the details. And in fact, we have to create the details. But the activists that bring it sometimes have very clear details, but it wasn't pronounced in the campaign. So the fact that we're having some tension, which is a good word, creative tension is good. Portland being nice and just rubber stamping everything kind of got us here. So with PSF, we're having that right now. And the fact is I like the fact that we have a lot of revenue, but we can't spend it on all the original ideas. Because you can only build so many nonprofits, and then how are they going to be sustainable for the long term, and what's their impact? And so I think when Commissioner Rubio did her level best to bring in the different edges and find some common ground, that was hard. I was really impressed with that, and I was definitely early on pushing for more in the bureaus. Like, what can the bureaus do? How can we shift towards an electrical fleet, if you will? How can we, you know, let's walk our own talk. And I also think we have to explore how this could be R&D money for the green economy for some in the private sector.
Right.
When I, you know, did a site visit recently where someone's doing the farming with water in a warehouse, the organic farming in a warehouse, they couldn't find a place in Portland, so they're doing it out in Milwaukee. Like, I want those in Portland.
Right.
And so I think we have to figure out how to walk that talk as well. The energy infrastructure, if you will, over where all the tanks
hub?
Are.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's got to be like federal, county, state, city, all of us, and include industry. Like, it's got to be a really tough table that everyone, again, checks the egos out the door. What's our goal? Our goal is safety and clean air. So I was the commissioner for the first time that said, we're going to deny a permit to Zenith, even though all the attorneys at the city told me not to, the bureau directors told me not to. I defied them. I was surprised when Commissioner Rubio and I received an invitation to meet with the heads of Zenith. We had it in our public calendar. It wasn't a behind-the-closed-door meeting. Mm-hmm. We just didn't think it was appropriate to invite the world to it. So we had to have that meeting. And in fact, I never thought about it. I just took the meeting. And they shocked me, honestly, when they said, we're going to choose Portland as the first site to reverse to renewable gas. Now, just a few years ago, renewable gas had activists jumping up and down as a step towards the right, you know, moving the ball down the field in the right way. So we signed up on it. Is that where we want to be 10 years from now? No. Is it moving the ball down the field? Absolutely. Did it avoid another 10 years of lawsuits where nothing changes and we're just dealing with the same crude oil that we've always had?
From my perspective, I was very pleased that this forward action was taken to deny Zenith's permit. And it felt like something that everybody in the city could agree on. And I hear that you have a different, the lawsuit, and that 3 days after your decision came out, the appeals board, whoever it was, they agreed that Portland did have the ability to deny the permit. From this point now, thinking back on it, do you have any, like, a different perspective on how it all happened, or anything that you would do differently if it was in front of you today?
I probably would have been more in front of explaining what was going on, because there was a lot of misinformation,
yeah,
like secretive meetings and such. to look at the long term on this one is really important. So today, people want their goods and services to arrive. We are dependent upon some sort of energy to make our city work. Then we need to look at what the North Star is. The North Star, of course, right now it's electrification. What does that look like? How do we not have unintended consequences by going too fast on that to the point where we're deforesting, you know, Forest Park to have what we currently see as electrical infrastructure? How do we get towards like what Asian countries are looking at with these batteries that are renewable and such? Like, we're kind of a third world country on some of this. This issue around the CEI hub is really big. And obviously, we don't want it right next to the Willamette River, but it's been there for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And it's what's also allowed us to be the river city that's prosperous. It's also grown into this big city. Mm-hmm. So the state, the feds, with the infrastructure bill, the federal delegation has to play a big role. But we have to provide them what the action plan is going to be. We have a little bit of a history in this part of the world of not taking action. We allow perfection to get in the way of good, so nothing moves. And so for me, it's about taking incremental steps, knowing what the North Star is and moving towards it.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of Running on Air, KBOO's Portland Candidate Roundtable series. We've been hearing what the future city councilors from District 2 told us on the campaign trail. Tune in for all the episodes of KBOO News Year in Review now until January 1st. I want to give a special thank you to all of the KBOO folks who helped make Running on Air happen. Thank you to the hosts, Lenita Duke, Barbara Bernstein, Don Merrill, Corey Elia, Annette Newell, Lisa Loving, Sam Bowman, and Reed Johnson. Thank you to the editors, Eric Leuschner and Ray Bodwell. And thank you to Ender Black, Arthur Rosato, Bob Davis, Nate Kapp, and Asia Hawthorne for all your help, too. I also want to thank KBOO interns, Patches, and Alex. None of the important work we do here can happen without the support of amazing volunteers, of course, and from listeners like you. If you've appreciated KBOO this year, consider supporting us with a donation. It's our end-of-year membership drive, so it's a great time to do it. KBOO.fm/give is the place online to donate. You can also text KBOO to 44321 or mail us a check. We love getting mail. Our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I'm Althea Billings, News Director here at KBOO. Thanks for being with us, and see you next year.
You're listening to KBOO